Hello and welcome to another episode of the Foxhole Companion with me, Dan Stewart.
And me, Simon Rance.
The podcast that brings you the chronological history of the Second World War as seen through the silver screen. And we're staying in the Soviet Union, Simon.
We are. So we are at, well, we're in Crimea, which seems very apt. And, or not.
Oh, there's some, there's a lot of references in this that are going to be very familiar to you all, given the current situation.
So the film we're talking about today is called The Battle for Sevastopol, or Sebastopol. So this is a Ukrainian-Russian co-production, unheard of now, of course.
Yeah.
but in 2015, it was just about still doable, although the tensions were extremely high between the two countries.
Because Russia had already retaken Crimea in 2014, right?
Yes. So you've got this. But the thing is, so this movie is called The Battle of Sevastopol. But it's really about two battles. It's about the battle for Odessa and the battle for Sevastopol. But mainly, it's a biography of Lyudmila Pavlichenko, better known as Lady Death, who was the superstar sniper in Stalin's Red Army.
You see, I think this is misleading, the title of this film.
Because, totally.
To be honest with you, as far as battles go, this isn't... I mean, it's the battle or siege or defense of Sevastopol, depending on which side you're on, mm-hmm. and then the same with Odessa, but it could have been any of them.
It could have been.
Because it's about Lady Death.
It's about Lady Death, and they are the two battles that she is mainly involved with.
Well, the only ones, actually.
Yes,
that she was
so obviously she's Ukrainian, okay, or... In this case, just Soviet, as a hero was portrayed by Moscow as, you know, being this indestructible sniper. And in fact, in Ukraine, the film is called Indestructible.
Is it?
Yeah. But it's a real wish-wash mismatch, and we'll talk about the film in a bit and how much of a mismatch.
Not that indestructible, because she died at 54 of a stroke, so...
Yes, well, she got heavily into the booze. But the point is, I mean, this
which is... really unusual for an Eastern European.
Oh, my God.
I've said it.
Okay, so... Pavlichenko was kind of... by the liberal West, was also seen as very much a heroine. So Woody Guthrie, the folk singer,
he wrote a song about it, didn't he?
Yeah, Miss Pavlichenko, and you know, with his guitar, "This Machine Kills Fascists." And there's a moment in the film which we will talk about in a bit, is so embarrassing. But are so many points in this film which are embarrassing. But it starts quite strongly, and we'll talk about. We'll talk about the similarities to the last film, Fortress of War. And then they don't last very long, though. Fortress of War, I think we both agreed, was pretty great. I hope you got a chance to see it.
Yeah.
There are some good performances in this film. And then there are some appalling ones. And then there are some ones I don't think you can blame on the actor, as they've been dubbed and redubbed and redubbed.
Oh, I still think you can blame the actor.
But the problem is with the film is that it is in both Russian and Ukrainian. So released in Russia and in Ukraine on the 2nd of April 2015. So in Russia, obviously it's in Russian. In the Ukraine, it's in Ukrainian. Now there's English in it because...
you've got Westerners.
Yes, and you've got Joan Blackham, who's probably, you know, third or fourth lead playing Eleanor Roosevelt, who befriended Pavlichenko. In fact, Pavlichenko stayed in the White House whilst drumming up support for the Eastern Front in the West. And then... you've got journalists, Western journalists, who are clearly Slavic, right?
Yeah, not even close.
Who are dubbed, just like, well, he looks kind of Western. Let's make him be an American journalist.
The funniest bit, though, it's so bad. It's dubbed by other Eastern Europeans, so it's not. They haven't got some English actors to dub it. So they're. It's anyway. Look, we'll get to the film. We're going to do Dan's brief history of the world quickly.
Very brief.
So I have to say, before we go any further, a couple of weeks ago, at a loss, late at night, I saw that Hunt for Red October was coming on the telly, which is one of my favourite films ever. We do like a submarine movie, don't we, Si?
We do.
And I was embarrassed, humiliated and ashamed to suddenly realise that in the last podcast, I described the brilliant Tim Curry as being the political commissar on the boat. Right. But he's not.
Right.
He's the doctor.
Okay.
Who lasts right to the end.
And who's the political commissar?
Just some guy. He's only in it for about a minute and a half.
Maybe it was a fever dream.
I don't know what I was thinking. Tim Curry is great in that film, and he's brilliant as the doctor. He's the only one who doesn't know what's going on because they keep him in the dark the whole time. So those of you who are listening to the podcast going, well, he's an idiot, he doesn't know what the hell he's talking about, you were right. All right, then.
Far be it from me to say such a thing.
Well, of course, you know. Oddly, in the large epic scope of the Second World War, these two sieges and battles really weren't hugely important. It's unlike the siege of Leningrad and the siege of Stalingrad, the largest land invasion in the history of the world. Really.
But isn't it more to do with they were two of the first big battles?
Yes, right. That's exactly right. So as we discovered in the last episode, Fortress of War, the Germans invaded the Soviet Union on the 22nd of June 1941. So the first one was the siege of Odessa, otherwise known as the Battle of Odessa, to the other side. So this is an odd one, Simon, because even though it was the Axis army, it was mostly Romanians who mm-hmm. led this attack, supported by Germans. Mm-hmm. The Romanian forces suffered 93,000 casualties against the Red Army's estimated casualties of between 41,000 and 60,000. So as you can see, as we're going to see probably throughout the Second World War, defending is a lot easier than attacking, as the Russians found out when they tried to invade Ukraine just recently, and as Ukrainians are finding out trying to kick the Russians out. It's much easier to defend, and usually the attackers suffer much larger losses than the defenders do. Having said that, the casualties just in the fight for Odessa is huge.
That is massive.
Yeah.
How long did it last?
It lasted 73 days from the 5th of August to the 16th of October.
Wow, that's a lot of death.
It is a lot of death. Both of these battles were marked by a particularly brutal aspect of modern warfare, and that was the fact that the Axis armies had basically complete air superiority. So for both of these battles, the Luftwaffe were able to fly around it unopposed and dropped a staggering volume of bombs onto these two cities. The Battle of Odessa was short. It was fierce. The lines of defense were broken through very quickly, and then there became this siege, this sort of stagnant period where both sides just sort of murdered the hell out of each other. The Soviets kept trying counterattacks that were usually futile and probably wasted countless scores of men for no reason at all. Basically, to break the siege, the Romanians had to sort of call in help from their German counterparts, who were led by General von Manstein.
So they must have been flying out of Bessarabia, like Romania, Moldova border.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Because Odessa's not exactly a million miles from there.
But both these cities were important because they were port cities. Mm-hmm. So you also have this strange aspect, which is not really covered in these films at all, of there was a naval battle going on as well. And even to the point that they were struggling so much with countering the Soviet navies that, hey, Simon, wait for it, they called in these infamously brilliant Italian torpedo boats.
Okay.
They bought by train, okay, from Italy, because obviously the Mediterranean was still hotly contested. You couldn't just, you know, sail stuff around. So they brought all these torpedo boats by train over to the Black Sea, dumped them in the water, and the Italians had at it. So that's how sort of widespread internationally this invasion was. So the Soviet counteroffensive, which was meant to break the siege, came during the night of the 21st, 22nd of September 1941, and it was basically the climax for the Battle of Odessa. The Soviets were thrown back and decimated, and during the last 10 hours of the battle, there was numerous bombing and strafing attacks against the Soviet bridgehead, which was basically trying to get as many people out as possible before the city was taken. In told, at the end of it all, there were over 17,000 Romanian dead, 63,000 wounded, and 11,000 missing, which is just astonishing. God. And then on the Soviet side, there were 60,000 dead, wounded, or missing. The Soviets then fell back to Sevastopol, which at the time was the strongest fortification on the planet. So the town of Sevastopol is a harbour, and it's surrounded by these huge cliffs. So it was sort of protected. And then the Soviets had built these sort of three lines of defence that were huge bunkers, concrete bunkers, gun emplacements. They even had, along the coast, these enormous naval batteries. So if you imagine the huge guns that would normally be on a ship had now been plonked onto the land. Mm-hmm. And the Germans, who were the main attacking force of this, again led by Erich von Manstein, and von Richthofen. Interesting to note that von Manstein survived the war, but was arrested and served 18 years for war crimes. He was not a very nice man.
No.
So the Axis land forces reached Crimea in the autumn of 1941 and overran most of the area, with the exception of Sevastopol. There were several attempts made to capture the city in October and November, but a huge offensive that was planned for late November was cancelled because of heavy rains. And as we all know, the weather in this part of the world plays an enormous part. Mm-hmm. So you had this winter period where it was a siege, and Soviets were dug in, the Germans were dug in, and it wasn't until the spring of 1942 that the Germans started to try and break through these Soviet lines, again, by land, by sea, and by air. To put this in context, the Luftwaffe flew 23,751 sorties and dropped over 20,000 tons of bombs in June alone. That's wow. 1 month. Basically, what they dropped on Sevastopol in 1 month was beyond the combined bombing of Warsaw, Rotterdam, and London to date.
Incredible.
By the end of the siege, there were only 11 undamaged buildings left in Sevastopol. It was basically completely flattened. They were only scratching the surface of the Soviet defences because they were all underground. The Soviet Navy attempted to repeatedly evacuate wounded, bring in doctors, bring in munitions by sea, and most of them were thwarted by the Luftwaffe.
And we'll see that during the Eastern Front as A common tactic by the Axis. It happens in Leningrad with convoy attacks, trying to break through for help, trying to evacuate people. it's the start of it's the start of war crimes on the Eastern Front, essentially.
Yeah, the sort of the total annihilation of all Slavic forces and people.
Well, that's it, because it goes after essentially the Soviet Red Cross. It goes, it's like everything is fair game.
Yeah, that's correct. Now, probably the most sort of depressing and probably predictable outcomes of this is that when it became clear that the city could no longer hold, all the Soviet high command was secretly put onto planes and onto submarines and taken away. So that would be General Petrov, General Otakar Bariski, and General Levchenko were all sort of secreted away. And basically the troops were left there. And as Simon was saying, the German army didn't really take prisoners at this point. So it was that on the 4th of July, 1942, the remaining Soviet forces gave up. They waved the white flag and the Germans seized the port. The Soviet army suffered 118,000 men killed, wounded or captured in the final assault. In total, they lost 200,481 casualties.
That's incredible.
In the defending of the port.
So essentially, two sold-out Wembley stadiums full of death.
Yeah.
Plus extras.
Plus extras.
That's an incredible amount of people.
The Axis forces lost 35,866 men, of which 27,412 were German and 8,454 were Romanian. It's interesting to me, Simon, and it says a lot about geopolitics. And we're going to come across this all the time with these modern Russian films, because they are somewhat reinterpreting history.
Well, there's a revisionist history involved in quite a lot of them. Not all of them, I have to say, but in quite a lot of
them. Yeah, we overlook, probably because we didn't have anything to do in terms of fighting them, but Romania was a huge part of the invasion of the Soviet Union. And it's interesting to me, Simon, that that a film like this made in 2015 doesn't draw attention to that at all, does it?
No, and I think it's because it's in the revisionist history, everyone has to be fighting the Nazis.
Right.
You know, and that's the most important thing. And the Nazi swastika, the defeat of that means so much to Soviet history and Russian history. As we know, like every year, it's about the how the Soviet Union saved the world from the
fascist invaders.
Well, but especially from Nazis.
Yeah.
And I think it's, if you're going to do something about Nazis, and let's be honest, if it's low grade propaganda, it's got to be German.
Yeah.
You know?
And also the fact that Romania was Soviet Union post-World War II.
Yeah. Well, a Soviet Republic, right?
Soviet Republic. Yeah. So they were basically on their side at the end of it all. So I just think it's interesting how they've sort of erased that little nugget. Very quickly, a little bit of background on Ludmila Pavlichenko. As Simon says, she was Ukrainian. She was she's credited with killing 309 Axis soldiers. And as we said, she served for the Red Army in the Siege of Odessa and the Siege of Sevastopol. She was born on the 12th of July, 1916 to Mikhail Belov, a locksmith from Petrograd. They moved to Kiev, where her father was a Communist Party member and had served as a regimental commissar in the Red Army and had even been awarded the Order of the Red Banner. Pavlichenko was a sort of tomboy. She became famous for being able to shoot very well, but she was also quite a studious student. She took her education very seriously. She enrolled at Kiev University in 1937, where she studied history and where she had intended to become a teacher. While she studied at the university, she worked also as a grinder at the Kiev Arsenal factory. She's basically Simon's perfect woman. On the outbreak of the war...
Well, yeah, because I always go for, glorified... Let's be honest. War is a very strange thing. She's like, how many 309? So essentially, she's a mass murderer.
Yeah.
Turned hero.
Yeah, exactly. Look, another way to put it, Simon, she was just very, very good at her job.
Yeah.
On the outbreak of war... unlike what the film was suggesting, which said that she wanted to carry on being a student and reluctantly was sort of frog marched into the army, according to her own account, she happily volunteered right away. They wanted to put her in into nursing to become a nurse. She refused. She said, no, I want to be in the infantry. And she was transferred to the sniper school. Where she, and much to the delight of this film, was top of her class in everything. In a little side note that just says a lot about the state of the Soviet Red Army at this point, despite being a sniper, weapons were so short that in her first combat, she wasn't given a sniper rifle, she was given one grenade. That's what she went into battle with. And it was only when a wounded comrade handed her his rifle did she start having at it and was immediately recognized by her officers as being a crack shot. During the 2.5 month siege of Odessa, she's credited with killing 187 soldiers.
Wow. 187 in 2 months?
Yeah.
What?
I told you she was
very... Did
she
sleep? That's insane. She must have been on speed or something.
God
That's
knows.
Incredible.
But she was one of the very few lucky ones who was withdrawn by sea from Odessa and sent straight to Sevastopol. So talk about out of the frying pan and into the fire.
Wow.
There she helped train other snipers who were also credited with killing over 100 Axis soldiers. She was promoted to lieutenant during the siege of Sevastopol. She's credited with killing 257 soldiers, making the final total that she killed before she was wounded 309. She was wounded by a mortar, which put her out of commission, and she was evacuated to Moscow, where she recovered from her wounds but was already a war hero. If you remember from Enemy of the Gates how they used Jude Law's character as a sort of propaganda machine, Pavlichenko was very much like that.
Oh, absolutely.
So much so that in 1942, they sent her on a sort of PR campaign. I mean, given the hostilities during the Cold War between the West and the Soviet Union, this is really hard to get your head around, especially given that the United States wasn't at war yet.
No, but I think that bit, although it's a problem because there's so much dubbing involved in this bit.
Oh, boy.
It's actually, parts of it is actually quite interesting. And obviously it's got, I was about to say Hollywooded up, but it's like, it's the antithesis of that, yet the other way round. It's like, you have to see this film. I'm not saying you have to see it because it's good. You have to see it because it's such a mess.
Yeah, really. Well, listen, the last thing before we get to the film, this is just the very last thing, because it is interesting and it does take up a large part of the film. She was very popular when she visited Canada and the United States. And as is made a lot of in the film, she became quite friendly with the First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt's wife. And she sort of took her under her wing. She would basically go to major US cities and stand up there in a uniform and, to talk about her heroic battles against the fascist invaders. But she took a lot of criticism at the same time. The US media, surprise, surprise, kind of made a joke out of her. And they sort of would comment on the length of her skirt and how that the American service women had shorter skirts. They commented that her uniform made her look fat.
Because that's really important when you're shooting people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they took, you know,
God
they would ask,
darn it, she's just not hot enough.
Yeah. and she was asked questions like, do you wear makeup when you're killing people? All this sort of stuff. But the high point was she was in Chicago and she was in front of a huge crowd, mostly men, I would imagine. And she said, gentlemen, I'm 26 years old and I've killed 309 fascist invaders by now. Don't you think, gentlemen, that you've been hiding behind my back for too long?
Amazing.
Which is great. And that, bizarrely, was received with a huge roar of approval. And she was very, very popular. She was given a Winchester Model 70 rifle, equipped with a Weaver telescopic sight. She was given a Colt semi-automatic pistol. She was made this big deal. Mm. And just to show you the differences between the United States and Britain during this time. Oh, no, it kind of makes me sad. So while she was being feted and wined and dined in the US, she did come to Britain for a similar sort of PR thing. It's worse, mate. She visited Coventry.
Oh, nice.
Where she visited the ruined cathedral.
Oh,
those
fair
of
enough.
You don't know, Coventry was carpet bombed in the early days of the war, and Coventry Cathedral still stands as the shell it was back in 1940.
It's absolutely incredible.
It is incredible. But she all, I love this though, Simon. She visited the Alfred Herbert Works and the Standard Motor Factory because they had raised £4,516 that paid for 3 X-ray units for the Red Army from the workers of those two factories. And I think that's sort of great. You know, they're in.
Well, that tells it all. That's union labour.
Yeah, it's union labour. But let's not forget that that money was raised by union workers in Britain who had already been at war for 3 years at this point.
Yeah.
And in America, she was being wined and dined and sort of was a media darling. Mm. And they weren't even at war yet. It's interesting. And yeah. Anyway, so she was given every kind of medal going. She was awarded the Gold Star of the
Shavlaki.
She was awarded the Gold Star of the Hero of the Soviet Union, as well as the Order of Lenin twice.
Mm.
So there we are.
Okay. So let's we're going to move on to the film. We'll start with the kind of technical aspects, or rather the production and the director and so on and so forth. So
I say at this point, my notes are basically from watching this film is a ripped out half page.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to your notes in a sec because that'll be quite amusing.
Well, they're not. I mean, there's nothing there.
No, but I will answer them for you because I bet you don't remember them.
Okay, go on then.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm just going to do a very brief plot. I mean, Dan's pretty much done it, but that was the truth. This is the film.
Now the film.
Yeah.
It's
okay.
A bit different.
Well, it is and it isn't. So there was a lot of talk when they were doing a production of the film, and Sergei Makritsky, who was a cinematographer, and you could tell that he directed the film. He was a cinematographer. The battle scenes are very good. The sniper scenes are very good. So and you could they're very well shot, those parts.
Yeah.
Other parts of it, not so much. Other parts of it, when it becomes melodramatic. I mean, in fact, it always does look pretty good.
Yeah.
It's the editing and the dubbing which is the problem. Anyway. So Sergei Makritsky, when he was brought onto the project, he was concerned that there wasn't enough about the truth of Pavlyuchenko. So in fact, it does steer pretty close to the truth. Although what Dan was saying, and we were both saying about revisionist history in a lot of these films, yes, Romania seems to have been completely removed. Now, here's a very brief plot synopsis, and then I'm going to talk a bit about the director and the actors. So, right, plot starts in 1937. Pavlyuchenko's a student, and she's just passed her entrance exams for the Kiev State University. This part of Ukraine, just like that part of Belarus, Brest in Fortress of War, before war has tainted their area, It is paradise on earth. It's a slice of utopia. The sun is beaming down. Everyone's in beautiful linen and traditional Ukrainian dress. Everyone's happy, apart from really Pavlichenko and her dad. Pavlichenko comes across as, they set it up very quickly that she's a really serious gal.
Yeah.
And her dad's a really grumpy git.
I don't think she breaks a smile in the entire film.
No, but she's very good in it. Yeah,
she is she's very good.
And that's Yulia Perisild. And I'm going to talk about her, but let me just finish this. Now, what's quite funny is that in the space of 122 minutes, she has, which is fair enough because it's like, it's pretty much over her entire life. She has three lovers. Yeah. So she has the first one that she becomes sort of involved with is Boris, who's a Jewish doctor. He ends up on the Eastern Front.
Played by Nikita Tarasov.
Yeah, and we have, then we have, is it Marikov, who is amazing. He's another grizzled sort of veteran sniper. Makarov,
played by Oleg Vasilkov.
Easy for you to say.
Now, and was he the fella that was also in...
No. No, we're going to get to him.
All right,
Then lastly, the person she falls madly in love with, who is played by Yevgeny Tiskanov, who played, best known in Fortress of War, as Three Beers.
Oh, he was great.
And he's good in this too.
The fella who ends up killing himself and his wife.
That's right, yeah.
When they're overrun.
Yes, who's basically the... they're called aunt and uncle.
That's
of
right,
Sasha.
Of the little boy.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the story in the sort of melodramatic thing. It's about a group of innocents going to war.
Thrown into the jaws of war.
How it changes them and, you know, the effect that it has on all of them. Her best friend, Masha, Boris, the doctor... Her love for Makarov, who doesn't give back that love because his family have already been wiped out, although he's clearly attracted to her. So you have all these kind of melodramatic parts in this very gritty war story.
Mm.
It is worth a look, but God, it could have been so much better. The best way for me to explain this film is that someone took an article... on the Battle of Odessa. Someone took an article on the Battle of Sebastopol. Someone's also typed in melodrama and then revisionist propaganda and then just like, but we need it in 122 minutes and gave it to an AI. That's what happened. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just got that feel. It's such a mashup.
Yeah.
It's like, what? What's going on here? You know,
it's
back and forth. And it starts quite strongly, but then it
does?
Just, well, kind of. Like the whole bit when they're at a university, you know, when they're at school.
All I got from that was that Pavlichenko and her friend Masha, who basically Masha, all she wants to do is get her end away with an airman. Well, it's true.
Yeah.
And the first scene, I think, is in Pavlichenko's house. And it's like she's talking to her mum about how she wants to go to university. And her mum's like, no, you got to work in the factory or whatever. And the kitchen is, again, much like in Fortress of War.
It's beautiful.
Is filled with delicious foods.
It's a bounty.
It has this golden glow of this beautiful Ukrainian sun flowing through the windows as this table groaning with food.
Groaning with food.
And you just go, this is the same country that had been starved to death by Stalin just 10 years earlier.
But it's very fertile land.
Fuck me. I mean, it's a fertile kitchen anyway. And then when you see them... So, Masha and Pavlichenko, Masha's always going, oh, come on, Ludmilla, let's go out and meet some blokes. And she's like, no, I must study. Even to the point where they're in a library and the librarian's like, could you leave, please? Could you stop studying?
Yeah, that's quite
Get
funny.
Out.
That's quite
and then it cuts to them on the beach. And I tell you what, San Moritz has nothing on the Ukrainian coast. Now, I know it's supposed to be beautiful. But again, this is shot through this sort of gauze of sunlight, and they're all in these beautiful bathing costumes, and everyone's, the boys over in the side there are playing volleyball, which Masha really enjoys that. And it's bizarre how they've, I mean, rose-tinted glasses doesn't even come close.
True.
It looks like the Soviet Ukraine was a food-filled, warm, sunny romp. I mean, it's just, I know better than that, you know, it's just, that's not the truth.
Okay.
The Ukrainians have been totally butchered and murdered by Stalin. There wasn't any food. This is madness. Anyway, that's my rant gone, because it is so, it's such an, I mean, if you're going to do propaganda, at least make it subtle. You know?
Well, I mean, there's nothing subtle about this film, that's for sure. So I'm going to talk about the lead actress now, Yulia Pereshild, who's Russian, not Ukrainian, okay? In fact, I think her family originally Estonian, or at least her paternal grandparents were.
All right, go on.
Now, she's quite interesting, as in, you know, it's, she's still relatively young, you know, she's like early 40s or late 30s now. But now get this. This is mental. So if you look her up, it will say stage actress, film actress, cosmonaut.
Ooh.
Now,
what's that about?
I'll tell you. Well, 2 or 3 years ago, she was selected as a member of the crew Soyuz MS-19, which launched on the 5th of October 2021. And it was to shoot a film called The Challenge.
Oh, I've seen that on her IMDb.
Which is either out now or is coming out this year.
Yeah, so the poster for it looks like she's in the sort of the cupola of the space station.
Yeah, they filmed on the ISS.
They actually filmed on it.
Yeah, she went up there with the rest of the cast and crew, and they filmed it in space.
Are you kidding me?
No. So the thing is, it's just like, even if she was the worst actor on Earth, I'd say she's tough as fucking boots if she's going to do that.
Holy moly.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, that's...
So the crew the film...
Yeah, they filmed it there. Not all of them, obviously. They didn't. I don't think they bothered taking the gaffer up there. Best boy.
Craft service.
Best boy. But yeah, the leads and the cinematographer and the director filmed on the International Space Station.
Oh, I can't wait for that film.
Well, I wonder if we'll be even be able to, if it'll even be released here. I mean, that's so sad, isn't it? Doing such a brave mental thing.
Here it
like
is,
that.
The Challenge, 2023. Yeah.
But the fact that the West probably won't even see it, the director must be like, Jesus Christ, all that work, and the only people that are going to see it are Russians. Ukrainians aren't going to want to see it.
There's, I'm looking at the cast here. It's a very mixed cast.
Really?
Of Western and Russian actors.
But it's a Russian director and the lead is Russian.
Klim Shipenko. He sounds Ukrainian though. No, he's not. He's born in Moscow. Wow.
Yeah, so I mean obviously that's just one part of her story, but that is pretty mad. You know,
God,
that
I've never even, I mean, that is, never even heard about that,
that. That is one brave actor.
I'd do it.
Yeah, I don't think I would.
Mind you, with the current state of my career, I'd pretty much do anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's either been such a hit or it's presumed to be such a hit. Russia has even put out a stamp for it already.
Well, they love their stamps,
it's
don't they?
Postage
stamp,
stamp
out for anything.
So other stuff that she has done, one which we will definitely cover. She's in the Fog, which is a great movie about partisans. Very bleak. Anyway, back to other performances. You've got, as we were talking about him earlier, Yevgeny Tishkinov. He was 3 beers in Fortress of War. So he's 44-year-old Moscow resident. Big theatre actor and other movies that we will know him from. He's also in A Rough Draft, He is in The Thor, which is we know he's in Fortress of War. And he is in the latest incarnation of The Master and Margarita, one of your favourite books. He plays the Master. He plays the Master.
Wow. I wonder how they're going to do the whole weird section with the cat and flying in the air and all that.
They'll work it out. So Makarov is played by I think this is the best performance in the film, Makarov. So he's like the grizzled sniper whose family have been taken from him, and he's this bitter bloke. Do you remember when when Pavlyuchenko is visited by the two airmen, Masha goes off with one of them.
And the other one tries to get
And the other one who plays the German spy dressed as NKVD officer
in Fortress of War.
Plays him. And anyway, Vasilkov comes in and does him in. And she says, "You don't need to keep rescuing me." And it's like, clearly he does, because he
rescues her several times.
He does indeed,
and that actually is one of the best action sequences.
Oh, it's great!
Is they're walking through an orchard, coming back from sniping somewhere, and he steps on this. It's not a landmine, but it triggers a flare going into the air, and it's this incredible overhead shot of them legging it through this orchard as this obviously zoned in artillery comes flying at them.
Yeah, that bit does look amazing, right?
It does look great, yeah. And if you just watch the trailer for this, that's in there, you'll see that, because it's quite a set piece. It's quite good.
Oleg Vasilkov, the best stuff that I've seen him in, I don't know if you know about the amazing Russian gangster movie called Brother.
No.
Right, so Brother is a proper hardcore movie. It's about this guy who comes back from the Afghan war, and he gets involved in petty crime and goes up, and it's all gets very mobbed up, and it's like a mix between a bit First Bloody, but like revenge, someone with PTSD. But the sequel, which I thought was even better, Brother 2, this dude, Oleg Vasilkov, is one of the main criminals in that. He's also in a very good film. Well, when I say very good, I thought it was very good, called Convoy. Now, it's not the Convoy that we've covered, thank God, because he's not gone back in time and made one of the worst British war films ever.
That's just shocking.
And it's also not the Convoy, which I think is Convoy 48, which we will cover, which is about the Leningrad Corridor.
Yeah.
It's essentially, if you imagine, you know, do you remember the Jack Nicholson and Randy Quaid movie by Hal Ashby, The Last Detail?
No.
Right, so they are taking two naval officers, are taking a prisoner to a stockade.
Yeah.
And they know what's going to happen to him when the MPs get hold of him, so they take him for a long weekend in New York on the way.
Oh.
And so there's like hookers, booze, you know, because they know he's going to get banged up.
Right.
This is a bit like that, but it's kind of sort of turns it on his head. The grumpy military man taking the prisoner is kind of shown the world and becomes a better human being for it.
All right.
But that is worth a look. Other performances. So Nikita Tarasov, who plays Boris.
He's good. I liked him.
He was good, right? He plays the Jewish doctor Boris. Now, he's from Riga, Latvia. He's done tons of stuff, man. But it's a lot of TV. I want to talk about one other performance who I thought was great. She plays Masha. It's Polina Pakhomova. Now, she kind of starts off in the usual sort of, ooh, giggly girl who's just in love. But her performance changes dramatically when she loses her airman. And she goes a bit, as you'd expect, a bit doolally. And she was supposed to be married that day. Do you remember that scene?
Yeah, so they invite Pavlyuchenko and her new fella to her wedding, and they show up. It's like in a quarry, and she's made a little
weird
sort of wedding table out of some rocks and put a blanket over it. But he's been killed.
Yeah.
And
she says it was going to be our wedding, but today it's now his funeral.
Yeah.
It's pretty grim.
Well, just to talk about the film a little bit.
Yeah, just a little bit, though. We probably should.
So, I didn't like this film, Simon.
No.
I was bored.
Yeah.
I was annoyed.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you've got these two sort of epic battles. And
one of the most fascinating stories ever.
Well, but just the battles, if you just take those alone and the number of people killed in it, they're sort of secondary to the story of this. I don't know how they get away with calling it Battle for Sebastopol.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Half the film isn't even in Sebastopol.
No.
It's really only the last 20 minutes it's in that. And just tell the story of Pavlichenko.
I mean,
that's what they're doing.
I mean, the film should just be called Lady Death.
That would be a great title.
Yeah.
Battle for Sebastopol, who cares? So it's the sections where she goes to the US and her friendship with Eleanor Roosevelt is interesting. It's
yet very poorly made.
Yet also terrible.
Yeah.
There's this section, again, I don't quite know what the Russians think the White House looks like, but there must have been enough diplomats who have gone in it over the years to have a better sense of what it looks like than this.
It looked like a Trust House fort.
Oh, it was terrible. So, for instance, there's one scene where Eleanor Roosevelt brings a dress for Pavlichenko to wear because she's been in this frumpy Soviet uniform the whole time, right, during her PR trek across America. She gives her this slinky, silky number and then she puts it on, but she's still got her combat boots on, and then she gives Eleanor her forage cap. And it's so obvious and so schlocky and just,
it's like the part when she gets to meet Woody Guthrie and he comes
Well, listen, we haven't talked about this. This is probably
one
of the most shocking sequences in any film we've covered. You can make fun of Convoy all you like.
Yeah,
we could talk about...
Yeah, that's true. amazing. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but basically, because it's so badly dubbed, and Woody Guthrie is blatantly played by a Ukrainian or a Russian with someone doing an American accent, but is also either Russian or Ukrainian over it, so it's not even him.
Yeah.
It's just like, well, hell, you're a real hero, Miss Pavlichenko. And it's just like, I wrote this song for you. And then he sings it. And like, it's like, you shouldn't be happy that someone is appalling. Although Woody Guthrie was clearly a genius, this Woody Guthrie is not.
Look, this is part of the problem, because it's not done... I don't know whether he's trying to do a Christopher Nolan-esque sort of thing, but it's not done, it's not a linear storytelling, right? So we constantly flash forward during the battles to her post-battle life as this PR person. And suddenly she's in the wings watching Woody Guthrie. I mean, obviously here's what's happened, right? Because you're all at home scratching your heads going, wait a minute, what? Woody Guthrie. The Russians have gone, oh, look, Woody Guthrie wrote a song about Lady Death. Now, Woody Guthrie was obviously one of America's great socialists, a union man, and his folk songs, you know, capture that whole side of American life that's constantly sort of buried, because God forbid, you know, anyone in America looked like a socialist. But this sequence between... Oh, mate. And so she's in the wings watching him sing this song. And he comes off and he takes her to his dressing room. Remember, this is a war film, mind you, right? This is a war film about the battle in Eastern Europe. And we're in this guy's dressing room in New York. And he goes, oh, I wrote you a song. And he sings it so badly. And he it's just... Oh, I can't even describe how jarring this whole... I mean, this is 20 minutes of the film where there's a sort of weird love story between them, but not really.
Not really. It's just... It's just.
What is going on?
It's just kind of there, isn't it? Well, there are so many parts to this film which are massive oddities.
Here's another thing, Simon, that made me really uncomfortable, right?
Go on.
when she's given her first sniper rifle, there's this sequence while she sort of caresses it and holds it against her face that is borderline sexual. Do you know what I mean? Well, it's like the sexualization of this gun.
I kind of get what you mean, but I think a sniper's attachment to their rifle is different from a normal infantryman. It's their absolute tool.
Well, I hope they're not stroking it and kissing it like she is. It's okay. Weird.
I don't think she was kissing it.
Her dad is this so overblown character. I mean, yeah, he's supposed to be NKVD, but he's such an asshole. So she comes home and she's like, oh, I got, but that's, you know, it. He's I came not first spo- in this he's, shooting he's competition. He goes, so what?
He's not
Do suppo- better.
He's supposed to be a party commissar. He's not supposed to be NKVD, is he? He's supposed to be Red Army.
Well, he was a political commissar.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, and then she goes, oh, I got into this university. Well, you should have done better. It's like...
No, he says, it's like, we're celebrating. It's just like, well, you expected to get in. Why would we celebrate?
Yeah.
He's really tough.
He's horrible.
Yeah.
What else have I got here in my very, very brief notes?
Please ask me the ones that you can't remember because I will wet myself laughing.
Oh, yeah. So I asked Simon about this because I wrote it down, but I don't know what it meant. Middle-eight shelling. And Simon's like, right. Oh, yeah, let me tell you about
it. Right, so like middle-eight being like the middle-eight of a song. Now, in the middle of this film, there's this kind of weird montage of mass murder and sort of cheeky grins between Pavlichenko and...
Makarov.
No, it's...
Oh, is it post-Makarov?
It's Kinsenko, yeah. Okay. The Venyi Tisganov character. So, and it's like there's like this sort of theme tune and it's like, oh, there's a group of Nazis and they're celebrating Christmas and they sort of look at each other and grin and then they murder them all and they're just like, ha, 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 and they sort of back away. It is surreal. It's like, wow, we know that we're kind of, she's already said, it's just like, well, after Eleanor Roosevelt says, wow, you've killed 309 men. And she says, not men. Fascists. And it's like, so to her, they're not human. And obviously to Leonid Kinsenko, they're not human anyway. But they are, right? They're still people. And they're about to celebrate Christmas. And they're just, oh, it's just so weird.
It's so dark. It's like
a
montage set to music of them just shooting people in the brain.
Well, that's all it is. Because they're all sharpshooters.
Now, here's another note that I had where you said, ask me about this in the podcast. Psycho Child, I wrote down.
Okay,
what's that about?
So Psycho Child, if you remember, there's one part where a little girl stands up and she goes on this massive tirade against fascists, just like, may their blood be spilled and like, we will sacrifice. I mean, basically... This child is the epitome.
Where does this happen?
She's Mother Russia.
Okay.
I can't remember. I think it's at like a town hall or a school. And they're all just like, yeah, ooh-ah.
Jesus.
It's a bit dark. It's just like, okay.
All right, here's... That's my notes. I just crumpled up, threw them in the bin. Okay. This film's bad. That's all I'm going to say, folks. I thought it was stupid. I thought it was bad. I thought it took something that is... could have been a really fascinating story and an insight into a real human being and real battles, was instead reduced to these stupid sort of propaganda points. It's they missed a trick with that.
Well, I think
Enemy at the Gates is much better. If you want to see a snipey movie. Snipey movie.
I think you're absolutely right. For me, the problem is with it deals with an extremely important story and extremely important person, historical person, with such melodrama. And it turns something which should be... I mean, if it was in the hands of a better director, it could have been... If it was in the hands of the director of Fortress of War, it could have been quite a sophisticated film. But it's not. It's a mess. As I said, it's like an AI movie. For me, it's because some of the battle sequences are very good. I'm going to give it a 2.
Yeah, I suppose a 2. I suppose mostly I was just really bored, Simon. To be honest, it was just boring, which is astonishing, given the actual the background of the real events and the real people.
Fair enough.
I just say the biggest propaganda in the entire film, though, is the way they have cast and portray Ludmila Pavlyuchenko and the actual Pavlyuchenko.
You're talking about beauty.
No, not just that, but if you look at pictures of the real Pavlyuchenko, she was a tank. She was an absolute... You could tell there's a coldness and a sort of harshness in her face where you go, yeah, that is somebody who killed 309 fascist invaders.
I don't think so. I think it's the other way around. I think the actress looks far more sinister, and she's got the eyes, you know, that you can imagine.
Do you think so?
I think Pavlyuchenko has a much softer face and a much more, face of innocence. I see that as the other way around completely.
Well, all right. Well, there you go. A controversy at the end of Foxhole.
Anyway, I mean, as you could tell, we recommend that you see this film. It's widely available.
Oh, yeah. You can get it for free on the Amazon What's It thing. Here's something exciting, though, Simon. Mm. So in watching this film the other night, it came up at the bottom. You know how when you finish watching a movie on Amazon, it says you may also like...
other montages of mass murder to music.
Well, Simon and I have come across what looks like an absolute ripper.
Yes,
which I think we're going to have to do next.
Yeah. So set similar time period, but back to the Finns.
So we're going back to Finland and their film Tuntumaton Sotilas, otherwise known as The Unknown Soldier, based on the ultimate best-selling Finnish classic novel of the same name, which has become part of the national legacy.
Yeah, so this film has been made, by looks of it, 3 to 4 times. This is the latest incarnation. It's supposed to be a very good adaptation of it.
And not with people who go by, oh, that's a good trailer, but the trailer is epic.
Yeah, true enough.
So that's what we're coming to next. We're going to press pause on Operation Barbarossa, and we're going to flick quickly north to Finland. And this looks like a great film. We're excited about that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, definitely.
Then after that, we're back to Soviet Russia, and
we'll do a double bill of Leningrad movies,
think. Here's a little thing, just want to say, because I think it's going to be next. I was just looking at it while you were droning on and on.
Rude. Go on.
What's it called? Pavlyuchenko's 28.
Pamphilov's 28.
Pamphilov's 28.
Battle for Moscow.
It's set in October, November 41.
But when's Leningrad? The start of the siege of Leningrad.
About the same time. They're all about the same time. That's the thing.
Okay.
But Pantelov's 48.
28. Convoy 48. Pamphilov's 28.
It's very hard to keep up with all the numbers.
T-34.
There's so many numbers, Simon. Pantelov's 28. It looks really good.
Well, it's brilliant.
You've seen it?
I've seen it like twice. Yeah, it's great.
Oh, I've not seen it yet.
I think you have. You've just forgotten it. Pamphilov's 28. In this country, is known as the Battle for Moscow.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I've definitely not seen it.
I'm pretty sure you have.
Have I?
Watch it tonight.
All right.
It's a cracker.
Okay.
Action sequences are insane.
Oh, good. Really? Well, there we go. We've got all sorts to look forward to then. So, in the meantime, you've been listening to...
The Foxhole Companion.